Campus FM presents Treasures from Malta. This episode was originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series, produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. Hello and welcome to Treasures from Malta, a podcast series produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. I am Francesca Balsan, an art historian and an artist with a long connection with Patrimonio. I'll be presenting this podcast and meeting some of Malta's living treasures. These treasures are artists, historians or art collectors with some Malta connection. They're all fair game for the pod and we want to share them with you. Hi everyone. My guest today is architect Richard England. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Francesca. It's my privilege and my honor.
Richard, you are embedded in the national psyche as the star architect from Malta. You've won several international awards for your architectural work and have received as many plaudits as can possibly be piled on just the one person. You have been honored by states, by various universities and by all of the important international architectural associations. But beyond architecture, which is perhaps your most public face, you are actually a man of many parts. You are a poet, an artist, a sculptor, an author, an art collector, a great lover of opera, and a deeply spiritual person. Richard England. Now, let's not be bashful. What is your greatest contribution to architecture?
Oh, that's not for me to judge. It's not for me to judge what might... I believe, look, if anything, success is a journey. It's not a destination. One makes tentative attempts at trying to put up buildings. My philosophy in producing a building is that a building should be ideally and specifically of its place and also specifically of its time. But most of all, a building must move the heart, must move the spirit. It's, remember that space is mood manipulative. When you walk into a space, it can either make you feel great or it can actually reject you. So we have to see how the geography of that space influences the geography of the mind. And we sense architecture not only visually, but with all our five senses.
Early in your profession, you spent a formative 18 months in the studio of the world-famous Milanese architect Giò Ponti. You have said that this is where you absorbed the basis of what was later to become my own personal architectural philosophy. What is your architectural philosophy?
Well, my architectural philosophy, let's go back to the first and possibly still the most important definition of architecture, which comes from the Roman architect Vitruvius. Commodity, firmness, delight. Commodity is obviously because architecture is a solution to a particular problem, is the sort of functional aspect, and that has to be obviously be something which is considered and actually solved. Firmness implies that the building is well made from a structural point of view, but those two elements do not constitute architecture. They constitute construction. What lives construction to the realm of art with a capital A or architecture is what Vitruvius refers to as venustas, which is probably beauty, which of course puts us into a very complex thing, exactly what beauty is. But basically what he is saying is that a building must move you. Le Corbusier has it beautifully. He says, we use concrete, we use stone, and that is construction. You lift my heart, that is architecture. That is what I seek. I do not think that it is important what my buildings look like, much as it is important, but it's what my buildings do to their users. Do the buildings actually give them a sense of spirit? In one of the wonderful books by Paul Valéry, Eupalinos, in a conversation, Ancient Greece, says there are three types of buildings. There are buildings which are mute. There are buildings which speak. But ultimately, there are buildings which sing. I search to try and make my building sing. Whether I succeed or not, is not for me to judge.
I want to take you back to your early days. Where did you study architecture, and where did you actually perform your early training?
Well, first of all, of course, my father was an architect, so there was architecture in the house. And my father was wise enough not to push me towards architecture. In fact, he pushed me towards a medical profession, and which certainly would not have suited me, because if I cut my finger, I'd probably wash it behind my back. And then at the early stages, I was always interested in drawing. It's the idea that you can depict something, and I've long ago discovered that the permanence of a drawing actually outlives the permanence of the building you draw, because buildings are transient. Architecture is the most transient of all the arts, funnily enough. We think of buildings as being permanent, but nobody would touch a painting, nobody would add a verse to a poem or a chapter to a book. But the moment the architect hands the building over to the client becomes the owner and might probably be demolished, especially if the land happens to cost more than what he had bought it for. So what influenced me were, of course, the 60s. Remember that when I was in Italy, it was the golden age of Italian architecture with Gioponti, Michelocci, Scarpa, and a horde of extraordinary architects, De Carlo, Moretti, and they all came to the studio. So that was a learning curve. Then, of course, there was the 60s itself, which was the decade which actually changed history. I mean, the pop art artists like Rauschenberg and Warhol, Eduardo Paolozzi, Richard Hamilton. Then in music, Rolling Stones, the Beatles, an extraordinary decade. I mean, Mary Quant, the miniskirt. Yep. You know, it was a whole. So this is something which really, and especially the Californian beat poets, Corso, Ginsberg, Bob Kaufman, who remains my favorite, who wrote these wonderful one-liners. I went to a masquerade party described as myself. None of my friends recognized me. It's about the masks we wear. So there were all these things. Then, of course, in Malta, there was independence, and that gave another surge. But we'll talk about that later, because that's the whole influence of a group of people who were looking for ethnic roots. And so there are a lot of things which actually influence you, because you know what? You become what you behold, as William Blake says. But apart from that, you need an intellectual overlay. And I was extremely lucky to meet a number of mentors, especially in the 60s, again, people who came to Malta. So I had personal mentors like Desmond Morris, because Desmond would have a problem. I was the architect for most of the people who came from abroad at that time. I was lucky enough to have that role. So 10 minutes to solve the swimming pool problem, and half an hour of a personal masterclass with Desmond Morris, with Victor Passmo, with Ernie Bradford, with Nicholas Montserrat, you know, extraordinary. And they all became very, very close friends. That was a legacy. And at that age, in your 20s, of course, you were absorbed. Mm-hmm. And one other mentor who I cannot not mention was Father Peter Sarajinan Glot. We met when I was 13 and he was 14. And he was the most extraordinary brain, which I don't think we'll ever see the likes of again on this island.
Incredibly so. You read for architecture in Malta University.
Yes,
at the time.
I started my architectural training in Malta. And I then moved to Milan, where I attended the Polytechnic. But my basic training was in the studio of Gioponti, because in those days the master would come down every day next to you. And there was I was working on one of the major projects was the church of the Hospital of San Carlo Borromeo. And so every day there was this argument about what is a church of today, why should the church be different? Because as we said, you know, the 60s changed everything. Even the church changed with Vatican II. you know, it insisted that the vernacular language was used so there was more communication between the celebrant and the congregation. And the congregation were no longer a series of spectators, but became participants. So there was all this sort of thing going on. And
we see this thought permeating your entire career, because you have designed a number of projects for churches and chapels. And whenever you've spoken about them, at least from what I have seen that has been published, you always speak about the congregation, the thought of the church, the presiding philosophy at the time. It all starts on a very metaphysical level, and somehow it is then translated into an actual design. Is that your process in architecture?
You know, one of the most extraordinary things, first of all, when you're designing sacred spaces, you're measuring against the immeasurable. Mm-hmm. And that's a tall task.
And you're containing the uncontainable as well.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, I have a theory. If one follows the words of Mother Teresa, who said, it's not so important what you do, but how much love you put into the doing. And I firmly believe that the energy, the dedication, and the love one puts into a project is actually absorbed by the materials themselves and then radiated back to the users. Mm-hmm. And you can make a distinction of a building like, I mentioned the Millennium Chapel, to a building which is done purely for monetary gain. Mm-hmm. So there is this aspect of how you measure, and then of course, what do you use as your major silence? Silence is one of the most important aspects, I think, of architecture, but the silence is also the internal spaces. It is the void which makes the architecture. It's the same as a container. The important thing about a container is what it actually contains. And silence, I once had the privilege of having a very long conversation with John Cage, who had written the famous 433, and I said, this is a piece about silence. He said, no, it's actually a piece to prove that silence is impossible to attain. Because while David Tudor, who was his pianist, sat with the 433 empty score and the closed piano, there were ambient noises. So people sneezing, people coughing, mm-hmm. You know, beeping using handkerchiefs. So, and then he went into an anechoic chamber to try and prove, and he was frustrated. He said, because the only sound I heard was the sound I could never eliminate, the sound of my own heartbeat. You know, I think the ultimate joy and possibility an architect has is to create a sacred space. You know, in the ancient days, the people who built the temples, architects were, I don't know, myth makers, magicians, high priests, shamans.
Yeah, visionaries.
And as Einstein correctly says, the ancients seem to know something which somehow we seem to have forgotten. And we've forgotten that because unfortunately today we measure everything in monetary terms. Mm-hmm. You know, the price of everything and the value of nothing. So when you're building or designing a sacred building, you're going well beyond all that. And it's the realm of trying to establish a link between the profane or the secular and the sacred, which is not an easy step, hence the threshold. The threshold is a very important space because you're neither in nor are you still out. Mm-hmm. But it's the threshold of preparation because you cannot go from one to the other mm-hmm. without actually preparing yourself. But it is probably the most noble and satisfying work one can face as an architect is to try to come to terms with the creation of what could aptly be termed as a sacred space.
So if I had to now take you to the materiality of the building, to the aspect, its form, its appearance, the minute I think about a Richard England building, what springs to mind is squares and bold colors. But I know that's too reductionist. And, for example, it excludes one of your early masterpieces, the Magna Carta Church, which is not square at all. So what are the hallmarks of a Richard England building? If I'm standing before a building that has been designed by you, How can I intuit that it is yours?
I'm not sure there is. There is obviously a signature, but it would be extremely difficult because each particular project is born from two necessary aspects. One of them is the brief, because the building can be a brothel or it can be a sacred space.
Mm-hmm.
So the brief is extremely important because architecture is, in necessity, the answer to a particular problem. And that's essential to remember, the preparation of a proper brief. And then, of course, there is that means what does the client require. The other is the site, the context, which is something which we tend to ignore in Malta, especially in the new buildings. The context is such that if an architect is sensitive, he can listen to the voices of the site, what I like to term the voices of the site. And the voices of the site will tell him whether he needs to be strong and make a statement, or whether he should sing in the chorus and not do a Pavarotti high C in the middle of a Maltese village. So it is extremely important to listen to those voices of the site and sometimes to sing in the chorus. You know, good manners are not amongst the most proficient and prominent of qualities of architects. Architects are egocentric and very much like their ego. I sometimes think that architects create, or rather architects commit suicide by jumping off their own ego. And so sometimes it's necessary to be... I mean, I was doing, for example, the Central Bank, the annex to the Central Bank. I had to make sure that the building did not go over the fortifications. So there, you see, the site dictated the whole philosophy of creating a building. Because at the end of it all, we must remember that being an architect involves not only being the designer of the future, but also the defender of the past. And that is essential. So, and also to ensure that what we put down is replaced by something which is better than what there was before.
Yeah.
And in many cases, you know, conservation, which is something which seems to be vanishing from the whole methodology of thinking, conservation means keeping alive. So the important thing at the end is to find a use which is specific to today's society. And this, for example, and I did St. James Cavalier, the brief was, we want to rehabilitate St. James Cavalier. I said, useless question, sorry. You know, what do you want to do? Well, we'll see later. I said, no, you can't see later. You have to find a use. And I had written the brief. And then, there again, you see, architecture became a verb, not a noun. Because what I was interested in was trying to make sure that the building, through its three stages, the time of the knights, the Brits, and my own intervention, those three particular periods became the narrative to anybody who was visiting the building, so he could understand, he or she could understand those layers and actually absorb. And in fact, all the additions are, in a way, installations, because I didn't touch the old walls.
By way of explaining about St. James Cavalier, it's actually part of the fortifications of Valletta, our capital city. And obviously it started out having a defensive function, the building had a defensive function, but then it went on during the British period, the colonial period of Maltese history, to take on different functions which were supportive.
The NAFI.
Exactly. So they were supportive of the general setup. In the last iteration, which was what you were asked to design, it was converted into a center for creativity. So a kind of a place where artists would come together, show their work, and hopefully create sparks of creativity which would carry forth.
The difficulty of the brief was that this was a building originally designed to keep people out.
Mm-hmm.
So now one had to redesign the building without destroying its spirit of place, to actually make it welcome people and as a gathering space and as a nucleus for creativity.
Spirit of place is something that keeps coming up in your writings. It's clearly extremely important in your outlook on architecture and on design. Can it be created by the architect in a new building, or it necessarily has to contain history? It has to contain the history of the happenings that occurred on the site, the history of the people who interacted with the site before the architect comes to design on it.
Look, normally the spirit of place is referred to as the genius loci. Mm-hmm. The genius loci is not only what is visible, but is also what is remembered, the mnemonic retention of a place. So, yes, I suppose a new building can have a spirit of its place, but it's a very limited spirit of place.
It's a shorter one,
I would like to think that some of the few remaining Maltese villages or Cossetan villages actually project what I mean by the spirit of place, the piazza in Arp, the piazza in Santa Lucia, because there you have the layers, the mnemonic layers of the church, the village houses, the little cross. So you've got all these things which come together and which are unique, actually unique to the island. Remember that Malta had only one building material, which was stone. So each and every of the vernacular buildings, because I suppose the spirit of place is about the vernacular buildings. The vernacular buildings are the buildings which Bernard Rudowski referred to as architecture without architects. And in most cases, it's much better than the architecture built by architects. Because it's a question of handing down knowledge from one generation to another to actually make a tradition. And tradition keeps improving. Unfortunately now, of course, you know, building materials have changed. And we're losing a lot of what I would call the genius loci and the spirit of place. And it's essential because eventually, as the world becomes a more of a global village and more uniform, the places which are going to be valued by people, also in terms of monetary values, are going to be the places which have retained some, at least some, of their spirit of place. There are a few places where I could mention Santorini. I did a book on Santorini. Santorini has also suffered from a lot of new buildings, but there is a building code which adheres specifically to the typology of the vernacular buildings. So the hurt, so to call it, inverted commas, is much less than what has been happening in Malta. In Lanzarote, there was a particular architect, Cesar Manrique, who also set up a series of rules. And much of the new buildings are they're not copies, they're extension of, because, you know, when one talks, I mean, my architecture, I suppose, can be defined as a regionalist approach.
Can you expand on that?
Yes, look, remember that I was a product of when the modern movement was at its absolute heyday in the 60s. And there were a small group of architects, very small, people like the Iraqi Rifat Charish, who later I worked for, Aris Constantinidis, Farouia Demasieris in Morocco. And we were published, but we were published always with a little bit of a smirk that we were, in a way, causing a little revolution. Because we were beginning to think, you know, it cannot be that all the world has the same trademark of architecture. We need to think of memory. We need to think of place. Mm-hmm. We also need to think of time. I mean, we're not going to copy what there was before, but we're going to use the modern. Remember that when the modern movement was founded by Gropius in the Bauhaus, he had said, modern architecture is a new tree with new roots. In other words, he was going to uproot all the old trees and start anew. And I would say, and we, the few of us, would say, it's not necessary to uproot the tree. Why not a new branch? Why not a new flower? Why not a new fruit growing off the old tree? Because change is necessary. Change is the most constant of all possible movements. So why not try and do something? And that's what I tried to do in the 60s in Malta, when there was this, you know, the effect of the zeitgeist of the age. And it wasn't only the group of people who were involved were Francis Abeyer in literature. His plays and his books were definitely Maltese, but not Maltese in a nationalistic way, but Maltese in a regionalistic
the aspect. Result of living in Malta, yes. Breathing its air and yes. Just absorbing what
and
was happening.
And that is very much about the spirit of place put into yes. Literary yes. Literary terms. I mean, there were the poets like Daniel Massa, Achille Nizzi. There was the music of Charles Camilleri introducing folk music into classical music. There was the artists of Enfin Cremona, Antoine Camilleri, who I think was probably the best artist of that period, Gabriel Caruana. You know, we're all trying to do something which stemmed from this cauldron of memory, history, visual aspects, and myself, I suppose, in architecture. Mm-hmm. So we were all led always again under the baton of Father Peter, who kept us all together.
Was it an orchestrated movement, or did you spontaneously drawn together because you had a similar
well,
outlook?
Well, we were originally probably individualists, but soon we realized that we were towing the same line, so we joined together. And one of the great things which I miss to this day was, for example, the studio which was run by Gabriel Caruana. Gabriel was a wonderful catalyst. He would get artists together. He would get so we would meet. There would be Francis Abeyer. There would be myself. There would be Paul Ashot singing. There would be Antoine Camilleri. There would be Carmelo Mangione. And this was
a real meeting of minds.
And that is something which we've lost. Because now there seems to be an almost fear of sharing what one is doing. I don't know where this comes from. It's probably because of the insular mentality. But this, I have been trying desperately to try and get architects together and say, let's discuss a project you're doing. Let's put it up. And, you know, let's not be afraid of criticism, as long as criticism is a positive criticism. You know, but there seems to be a little bit of a barrier.
Were there any tangible results from these meetings, apart from obviously supporting all of you in reinforcing what you were thinking and how you were thinking differently
well, we got
from
a lot
what was
of
generally
support.
Happening.
You know, one of the interesting things is we got a lot of support from the people who came from abroad,
mm-hmm.
You know, who I mentioned before. And
like Victor Passmore.
Yes, like Victor Passmore and you know, Basil Spence. Mm-hmm. They bought Maltese art. Passmore's house has many works by Gabriel Caruana.
But did they buy them as a sort of a curiosity, something that reflected Malta, or did they actually appreciate them in terms of international trends?
Yeah. I think definitely they appreciated them, because it was a movement which was also novel on international levels. This idea of trying to do something, because as I said, it opposed the international style.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but remember that the 60s was the years of change. You know, one of the things which, in a way, disappoints me to this day is when Malta was admitted to the European Union, I thought there would be the same resurgence as there was when independence took place.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing. Or also when Valletta was the
capital of culture.
Capital of city, of culture. What is the aftermath? What have we got? What is the legacy?
This episode, originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series and now being broadcast on Campus FM, is a conversation between me, Francesca Balzan, and my guest, architect Richard England. And we're back. Pictures and links are on the podcast section at www.patrimonio.org. And don't forget to give us a follow on the Treasures from Malta podcast pages on Facebook and Instagram. Renzo Piano says this about you. Richard England is a master builder. His is an architecture which is local, but also global. His language is a language of poetry. all fine words and true, of course. But, Richard, have you ever held the tools and built a wall with your own bare hands? And is it important to experience the craft of the builder if you're going to go about designing buildings for them to execute?
Oh, absolutely. My first project, let me start from here, was Manikata Church. When I came back from my work period in Ponte Studio, my father said, I'm going to give you a present. I'm not going to give you money, and I'm not going to give you an object. But about 2 weeks ago, I got a commission for a church at Manikata. This is yours. Regretfully, he never saw it finished because he passed away before the completion of the project. But when I prepared the drawings, and I went up to, because the villagers wanted to build this on a voluntary basis, and I gave them the drawings, and 2 weeks later I went and I said, okay, now where are the drawings? I can begin to explain where, you know, things are laid out on the ground. The chief guy over there said, well, there's a little bit of a problem. None of us can read. So then the whole process became very much like a medieval architect would probably have built a cathedral. So I had to go up and literally choose the stones myself. So I've always told my students that once in your lifetime, make a building with your hands, because it makes all the difference. Because when you design a building, you make a means to an end. But when you actually handle the stones, and actually, it's a completely different thing.
Talking about Manikata Church, let's hear what somebody who became rather important in your life had to say about it. Victor Passmore, who we've mentioned, he is actually considered the greatest British post-war abstract artist. And he said this about you. When my wife and I first came to Malta in 1967, we were driving around the north coast of the island. When up on the hill towards Manikata appeared a large building, which from the distance looked as if it had been designed by Le Corbusier. When we drove up to inspect the building, we found it to be a new church. This seemed to be so remarkable in a country where all the churches are sophisticated developments of Baroque that I asked who the architect was and was told it was Richard England. Bravo, Richard. Passmore would subsequently settle in Malta and live and work on for many years from his farmhouse in Goudia, in which he had a very great hand in choosing and helping him develop it. Tell us about your relationship with Passmore. When did you get to know him and how did this friendship develop?
Well, I got to know him in a very weird way because in the 60s, of course, we were doing a lot of houses at the office for people who came over from England. So I got this telephone call from somebody at the Phoenicia Hotel who said, well, there's a Mr. Passmore who would like to have a word with you. He'd obviously already had seen
the Manikata Church.
And at that moment, Passmore didn't mean anything to me in the sense that I didn't make any connection. And when he started talking and just saying, I just saw your church and I loved the interpenetration of external space and internal space. And so I said, this guy sort of seems to know what he's talking about. So I said, excuse me. I said, he said, well, I'd like to come to your office because we're looking for a property and I'd very much like to have your professional advice. So I said, okay, fine. I said, but may I ask, I said, what exactly is your first name? He said, Victor Passmore. I said, it wouldn't be the Victor Passmore. Well, I do paint. What's his answer? So I said, no, you're not coming to the office. I'm coming to the hotel. And within 2 days, we found this farmhouse. And as we walked into the courtyard, it was a habitable Victor Passmore, with the little dovecotes and the white line. It was absolutely incredible. And then he asked me whether I would help him out on the design of this, and gradually we became extremely good friends. We used to have lunch on every alternate Monday, always at the same restaurant. I won't mention the name, and I would say, where are we going, Richard? He said, always the same, Richard. where the food is the worst in the Mediterranean and the view is the best. I'll tell you later which one it was. So what did I learn? He was a great mentor, a tremendous mentor. He taught me about the dialectics of space and form. He taught me about the harmony of opposites. And this is because even his own work is Fate and Reason, Science and Religion, even his books, Burning Waters. There always seem to be contradictions for us. But he was very, very interested in two aspects. One, he was very interested in Giorgio de Chirico. He thought Giorgio de Chirico was even more important than Picasso. But more so, he was very interested in the Japanese feeling and understanding of the yin and yang. Japanese are, in a way, very difficult for us to understand. I mean, there's sumo wrestling, harakiri, and on the other side, insect listening, kimonos, the wonderful temples, which to us are seemingly contradictory ways of looking at life. But they somehow bring them together as a totality of yin and yang. So he was always very interested in this idea of how there is a harmony, even in contrasting what we consider to be contrasting opposites. And then, of course, the silence of the in-between, which he often referred to. So, you know, and the famous Klee quote of a lion going for a walk. And also, ultimately, he taught me about the elimination of the non-essential. And in a way, I learned that, and I've now, even to this day, if I'm working on a project, if I'm working on, even if I'm writing, when you're actually involved in the work, you are very subjective. And you also have a sense of almost physical satisfaction of actually finishing this work. So best you leave it for a few weeks and look at it from the top objectively. And then you can criticize as if you're an outsider.
You've written a number of books on Maltese contemporary artists. Tell me who you chose to write about and why.
Envin Cremona, because I think he was a pioneer artist, more on his broken glass and abstract work rather than his religious art, which I always found a little bit mannerist. I thought the greatest artist, although I didn't write much about him, unfortunately, of that period was Antoine Camilleri. And the most inventive and innovative, without a series of doubt at all, is Gabriel Caruana. Mm-hmm. And I think I penned 3 books on Gabriel. And wonderful ceramist. And of course, well ahead of his time. Because when in the late 60s he had an exhibition with tires, and with bus tickets blown up as works of art. It was very much what was happening outside the world, you know, and the rest, the art movements.
Was he doing this in the knowledge of what was going on abroad?
I don't know, because it's very difficult to say whether Gabriel was intuitive. I think he was more intuitive than intellectual, but he produced like an absolute maniac. It was incredible. There was this energy. And we got on extremely well. And as I said before, one of the wonderful things was that he was this eminent catalyst of bringing artists together and to discuss. Mm-hmm. And there were always these heated discussions. I mean, Antoine Camilleri pontificating on, and Father Peter would be there trying to put in a philosophical sort of overlay to all the rubbish that we were probably saying. It was a great period. But those were the ones I... Then I wrote about Norbert Attard. Mm-hmm. I did a book on Norbert. I wrote a lot on Mary DePiro, who as a young artist, I think, was one of the most promising landscape artists, still is to this day. And so quite a number.
You mentioned this group of...
And Kaleya, of course, Joseph Kaleya.
Who you knew, I suppose.
Yes, I knew.
Yeah.
But
Not very many women. You've just mentioned Mary DePiro. No female architect, no women artists.
Well, were there female artists in the 60s?
What kept them away from joining this
group? I don't
know.
There are a lot of very good female artists now. I mean, there was later, there was Isabel Borge, there was Borge Cardona.
Celia Borge Cardona, I'm sure you have curated a number of exhibitions.
You were the curator. But that was a wonderful exhibition. In fact, I remember telling her, I said, I haven't seen an exhibition like that since the 60s.
But talking about other artists, let's now turn the focus on to you, because you are an artist very much in your own right. Your published drawings are extensive, and I know you have scores and scores of others stored away. Your style seems to vary from the purely architectural to the fanciful. The buildings always seem to remain the subject. So what is your process? Do you draw regularly? Do you draw daily? What media do you use?
I need to draw just as much as I need to breathe. And also, there's another thing. The drawing is a little bit like being an athlete. If you don't keep going, if I don't draw for 2 weeks, I fear the first stain of ink I'm going to put on the paper, and I hesitate. And after that, I get back to it.
Are you scared of the blank white?
Yes, of course. Yes, but it invites as well. It gives you a sense of fear, but it also is a temptress. It's a temptress. It's a mistress. It's almost an alluring mistress. But the important thing now is that because young architects no longer draw, that we do not let the mouse kill the pencil.
Yes. You have said that the bridge between mind and paper is still best crossed by the hand.
Absolutely. You know why? Because when you sketch, the sketch is free, and it takes you to places where you've never even imagined you're going. And there's a freedom. It's a dance. You know, the lines twirling, twitching, you know, scratching all over the paper. It's almost like visual music. It's one of the most beautiful things about drawing.
So when you sit down to draw, are you switching off the architectural side in the sense
that...
Oh,
that's a very interesting question.
Is the drawing taking on a life of its own? Do you let it lead you?
Look, one of the great problems about being trained as an architect is you're trained to draw orthogonally. So in a way, yes, okay, that serves its purpose because the architectural drawings at the end are a means of communication in order for people to be able to carry out what you have designed. So in themselves, mind you, I have a different tendency. My own sketches have an existence of their own. I tend to want to finish them almost as finished drawings. By the way, I've just donated 600 drawings to the university.
Yes, that is a very significant
I hope it will at least tempt young architects not to kill the pencil and use only the mouse.
I think we're all enriched by that donation, thank you on behalf of everyone.
Kind of you to say so, but you know, the necessity of drawing as an artist is completely different. So in a way, you've got to relearn how to draw like an artist after you've learned to draw like an architect, which in fact is even more difficult than if you had not learned to draw like an architect. So there is this sort of dichotomy, and there is this sort of thing. My drawing, I think now, even my architectural drawings are more of an artistic work of art in the sense, not of a sense of praise, but in the sense of it's the work of an artist more than the work of an architect. But I don't think people realize how many drawings you, for example, I churned out 100 drawings for the project of the church at Aura, which I donated to the university, part of the gift. That's 100 drawings. You hardly realize that when you... It's only when you look through them afterwards and...
So difficult one here. On his deathbed, Leonardo da Vinci reputedly said, I have offended God and mankind because my work did not reach the quality it should have. First of all, what an overachiever. But apart from that, do you feel you have reached the pinnacle of your profession, or is there a whole lot more you want to say?
You don't reach a pinnacle. If you think you've reached the pinnacle, you've closed. When people ask me, what is your best building? I know it sounds like a cliche, but it's the next one.
The next one.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, because that's the only thing which keeps you going. Mm-hmm. The belief that what you're going to do next is going to do better than anything you've done before.
Mm-hmm. Conversely, if you had to look back on your career and projects that were you had come up with, you had designed, but they were never executed. Is there something that you would have really wished to see executed?
Well, I would have, yes, really loved to have seen the Filfla Chapel. Because the Filfla Chapel was, again, a proposition for the millennium.
It is remarkable. Talk us through it.
One of the things I think a lot of people didn't realize, I mean, when the millennium was about to sort of hit us, most of the concerns were about computers stopping and
millennium bug.
Millennium bugs and going to zero and all
no,
that.
No, it's the COVID bug.
Somehow or other, I don't know how that got into people's minds, but that became the issue. And then it was a question of a feast. And many people, I think, many nations, tended to forget that, in fact, this is a Christian celebration. It's 2,000 years of the birth of Jesus Christ. And so I thought one of the things we could do is, why not go to the earliest deities in Malta, which of course are the buildings dedicated to the mother goddess of Hajar Aym and Imnida. And next to Hajar Aym, because Hajar Aym actually changed its axis to look out onto Filfla. So Filfla was a sacred altar. Mm-hmm. Something of tremendous importance to them, because the symmetrical layout of the Hajar Aym temple is completely changed in order to orientate itself towards the islet of Filfla. So I thought, why don't we take this pagan altar and try and Christianize it? Because that's what the millennium is about. So I proposed to dig into the earth, make a window which overlooked
to the cliff face, literally. So you wanted to dig into the cliff face.
I wanted to cliff into the cliff face, then a few steps down, just have a window, and just look out on this altar and just have a cross. The cross also had a sort of reminiscent idea of the crossfire things you find in guns, because Filfla, of course, was regrettably used as target practice. So that would have been a project which, and then of course there was a giant cross on the cliff face. Mm-hmm. So from the seaside you could see that. But that again, when presented.
How well do you know Filfla?
Oh, I spent a night on Filfla.
Tell me about it.
In my madness.
First of all, how does one get permission to spend the night on Filfla?
No, this was a long time ago, and I don't think you needed permission.
or if you did, I botched it.
No one
is allowed to actually land on Filfla.
Miriam was away, because I don't think she'd have taken very nicely to this idea. But and I went down to Witizuri, and I said, would you take me to Filfla? And found the fisherman. He said, yes, of course. Yeah. So this is pre-mobile days. So this guy rows me over and drops me there at about 11 at night. And he says, I'll come for you tomorrow morning. I had the idea of trying to clamber up to the top, but it's too dangerous. But the sounds, the alternating silence, the lapping of the waves, the bird songs,
the birds,
and the flapping of the birds' wings, and the roll of the sea is one of the most poetic experiences I've ever had. But suddenly it crossed my mind that if this guy happened to pass away, or decide not to come for me, or to say to hell with this guy, why? I mean, what am I going to do? Wave a white
tragic cast away, sort of.
Yes, and sort of starve to death on this iceberg of stone, as I call it. I've written a lot of poetry on very inspirational. But he did turn up. He even turned up with a warm coffee, which was most, because it was pretty cold, even in August.
Was there an element of fear, apart from
well, the element of fear was there were a lot of unexploded shells.
Ah, okay.
And a lot of crumbling rock. No, fear, no. No, in fact, it was almost like coming home.
What I'm trying to ask you here is, what was the spirit of place like there?
Oh, it was... Look, it's a sacred island. Again, the vibrations there. It's been ruined by this bombing and all. But there is a very, very strong atmosphere. It's also about the silence and sound, you know, the play between silence and sound. Very, very important, which comes out in poetry.
Did you sleep that night at all?
No. No.
I mean, you were obviously physically uncomfortable, I would imagine.
Oh, yes, very
fear of, like, as you say.
But I wanted to take in, I wanted to take in the atmosphere, because I was interested in writing poetry about Schiffler. And I was doing a book. So, a poem for seeing with poetry and photographs. And it's necessary because when you draw something, it stays with you. With photography, it's instantaneous, but I had to do photography because I didn't want to, I did a few sketches of Schiffler, but it's a limited subject to draw. So it was necessary to actually experience the spirit of place of that. And it was a rewarding experience.
Very unusual, because none of us can ever do it.
No, now you can't do it.
Tell me about your love for opera. It obviously goes beyond attending performances, and tell me about your collection as well.
But actually, the love for opera is the love for the tenor voice.
Mm-hmm.
It's which was initiated by my grandmother. My mother, unfortunately, was lost in my childbirth. She died at the age of 25, which has left a little bit of a load on my whole essence, almost feeling like I have to justify two lives. But anyway, forget that. So I was brought up by my grandmother, very Victorian, very strict, who would read me Dante at the age of 6, and there was no way of getting away from it. She would sit me down and read Dante, read De Amicis, read Shelley, and read. But I'm very grateful to her because she instilled in me the whole cultural aspect, and obviously opera on this hand ground
on a gramophone yeah.
with a horn. Mm-hmm. And Caruso, of course, was the great voice. And I somehow fell in love with this extraordinary sound, because it's not a natural sound. It's, mm-hmm. It's a forced voice. And then, of course, there were the Mario Lanza films, and Lanza was contagious, as he was contagious to most tenors. Even he was born 100 years ago this year, and there were a lot of articles, by, including Joseph Calleja, paying tribute to Lanza. I was always a Lanza fan, but Lanza in those days was cast aside by the so-called conoscenti. But it was probably the most beautiful natural voice, apart from Giuseppe Di Stefano. So I started collecting records with my little pocket money, going around and buying old records. And there were a hell of old records, a lot of old records around in Malta because of the opera house.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the interesting things which came about was that at a particular place, I unearthed a lot of about 30 records. And amongst them was what was termed a black gramophone and typewriter, because that was the company, which was a recording by Giovanni Zanatello. Zanatello had come to Malta for the 1900-1901 season and had a great success. Went back to Milan. He was not yet a celebrity, because later he became a great celebrity. He's the greatest exponent of Otello, and he was the founder of the Arena di Verona. And he also gave Maria Callas her first role in, so if he's remembered for nothing else, he's remembered for those. and it was on a black label, and he recorded 5 titles, and I found the 6th, 1 copy. Nobody's ever found it.
Wow.
And in 1996, the BBC ran a program to find the rarest record in every category, jazz. And this was voted as the rarest operatic record. So the collection has extraordinary. It has the Eric Caruso recordings.
You keep adding to it even
nowadays. Oh, yes, it's 12,000 records.
That's remarkable. Probably the largest collection.
Yes, it's one of the largest. In fact, one goes. And, of course, I've got practically nearly every tenor who actually made a noise on record. I mean, from Caruso to Callejo. Yes, with you. And Joseph used to, when he was very young, he used to come over to listen to the Golden Age sent over by his teacher, Paul Asher.
Do you listen to music while you're drawing?
Yes.
Does it affect your line, do you
no,
think?
No, but then if I listen to classical music, like my favorite composers like Philip Glass, Avro Part, Goreschki, then I don't do anything else because those demand 100% attention. If you listen to Beethoven and try and do something else, or listen to Bach, I think that's almost an insult.
When did you start writing poetry, and is it an expression of your spirituality?
Poetry, I don't know, I started writing poetry probably about 30 years ago, 35 years ago. It's not very different from architecture.
In what way?
You're building with words and silences. In architecture, you're building with solids and voids. But I'm also interested in how a poem looks, the visual aspect.
Yes.
But the silences in the poem are probably more important than the words. Arthur Schnabel, the great pianist, was once asked, "What makes you the world's greatest pianist?" He said, "The notes I play like anybody else. But the silences in between, that's where the secret lies." A poem must impress you before it's understood. It's the beauty of the words. It's the cadence of the words. These are extremely important aspects of poetry. Yes, and a lot of the poems are about spirituality, about death, about...
Does death scare you?
It doesn't scare me because I've come to realize it's just part of life. But what it does do is it makes me realize that time is short and that things I would like to do need to be done. So there's not time to waste.
Yeah, I think we all share that.
I wrote a book on Lazarus, because surely one of the most frustrating characters in the whole of the Bible.
He should have told us what it was like.
Exactly. He spends 4 days in the afterlife, comes back, and remains absolutely silent. Now, why does he remain silent? Also because, first of all, it's the most important of Christ's miracle. It's the miracle which actually forces the Pharisees to crucify Christ, because, you know, raising people from the dead is a wee bit too much. But this guy comes back, doesn't say anything. Now, why doesn't he say anything? Is it because he was forbidden by divine mandate? Was it because there was nothing? Was it because there was something which was so enormously great that he could not find the right words to describe it? We don't know. Three things I'd like to say at the end is, I think architects at the end should remember the words of Jorge Luis Borges, that my business is to weave dreams. And the other is Tennessee Williams, "I don't want reality, I want magic." And my own ambition is to produce an architecture where the floor is the earth, the walls are the wind, and the ceiling is the sky.
Thank you, Richard. This has been a wonderful hour spent with you. We're all enriched by it. Thank you so much for your contribution to architecture, but so much more to the arts, actually, in Malta.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure and honor. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Treasures from Malta on Campus FM. This was originally recorded as a podcast, and there are pictures and links to all we've discussed on the Fondazione Patrimonio Malti website under the podcast section, That's www.patrimonio.org.